Well, good afternoon and welcome to today's Senate lecture. I'm Jackie Morris, the Deputy Clerk of the Senate, and I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land that we're meeting on today, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, and their elders past, present and emerging. Today's lecture is being live streamed on the Australian Parliament website and through the broadcasting system, so welcome to those of you who are joining us online. It's also being Auslan interpreted and captioned. If time permits, when we get to the end, we'll have a short question and answer session, as long as our speaker is willing. I'm delighted to welcome Commissioner Rom Mokak to deliver today's Senate lecture. Rom is a commissioner with the Productivity Commission and is a Jugun man and a member of the Yaru people. He has almost 30 years' experience working in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander policy and programs, including as the CEO of the Lowitja Institute, CEO of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, and most recently as the Productivity Commission's first Indigenous Commissioner. He's currently working on the Productivity Commission's review of the National Agreement on Closing the Gap, the final report of which is due in December of this year. In today's lecture, Rom will draw on his extensive experience to reflect on the importance of centering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in policy and evaluation that's aimed at improving the lives of Australia's Indigenous peoples, or First Nations peoples. Would you join me in welcoming Commissioner Mokak?
Jackie, thank you for that introduction. I think I'll just go straight into it. As a Jugun man, I give my deep thanks, my sincere acknowledgement and greatest respect to the rightful owners of this place, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. I honour their ancestors and their elders. I honour their knowledges, their stories, their practices. Their generosity has allowed me and my family to call their home our home for the last 25 years. This kindness and generosity is observed across the country, right across the many nations that are First Nations of this continent. During almost 20 years of working in public policy, my time has been spent about equally within government and the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander sector, and my work is better for having spent time in both sectors. In the state and Commonwealth, I work largely in health, ageing and disability policy. And in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander sector, I headed up the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, the peak body for Indigenous medical graduates and medical students, and the Lowitja Institute, Australia's only Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled health research institute. For the past 4.5 years, I've been a commissioner at the Productivity Commission, and I'm now entering my last 6 months of my 5-year term. My focus is for the Commission to have the mindset, the leadership, the capabilities and the tools to carry the important work forward. So beyond proper engagement, the commitment to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander self-determination and empowerment to be embodied institutionally. The strength in knowing who I am as a Jugun man, where I'm from, our home Rubibi in Western Australia, and why I'm here keeps me grounded and focused. My people, culture and identity provide the foundations as well as the guidance for the contribution that I might make. And Indigenous people the world over are and always have been connected through time, past, present and future, to each other and to country, to land, to water, to sea, to sky. These things matter, however, these are not the things that are often contemplated front of mind or acted upon by policymakers and decision makers. This is but one reason why Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people must be the designers, the architects, and the drivers of our futures. In early 2006, on Gadigal land, on invitation by the then Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, Professor Tom Calmer, I spoke at the launch of the 2005 Social Justice Report. Chapter 2 of that report is titled Achieving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Status and Life Expectation Equality Within the Generation. In it, Tom called for a campaign for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health equality within a generation, taken as 25 years. That gave rise to the Close the Gap campaign, with government's response being the Closing the Gap agenda, launched in 2008. In my speech, I quoted eminent Quandamooka poet, the late Udjuru Noonuccal, who said, "I don't hold the present generation responsible for the past, but I will hold it responsible for the present and the future, because it is its responsibility and mine to change things for the better." We are now 15 years into that generational marker. With only 4 of the 19 targets across 17 socioeconomic areas on track and 4 going in the wrong direction. The focus of my conversation with you today is on the need to centre Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's perspectives, priorities, and knowledges in policy and evaluation. In attempting to address this challenge, I want to explore two things: power and knowledge, or knowledges. And ultimately, this is a question of where power sits, if and how it is shared, and who decides. This requires a questioning of what and whose knowledge is valued, by whom and how, what is in frame and what is not. And it's more than the data, it's more than the statistics that tell our story in a limited and harmful way. Beyond the temporal transactions, to systems that adapt and improve, not constrict and constrain. It is fundamentally about a renegotiation of the space between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and governments. Drawing on the Yolngu concept of Garma, the mixing of salt water and fresh water to create an intersectional space where new knowledges and new possibilities emerge. I ask, how fertile is that space for new ideas and new arrangements to take shape, or for creating space for the things that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been advocating for decades? Beyond poorly conceived policies, programs, and of course the never-ending pilots, beyond predetermined decisions made by others who seek to say what is good for our people, beyond claims of beneficence and benevolence in the face of overt racism and the denial of our humanity, and instead toward achieving sustainable change on the terms that have meaning and value for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I also want to point to areas that I will not cover today. I'll not provide a summary of the history of oppression, dispossession, and exclusion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I will not give a summary of the history of policies and programs and associated harms. And I will not do a run through of the Closing the Gap targets and how they are tracking. All of these matters are written about, reported on, and publicly debated. And I would expect a level of understanding about these matters in 2023. I will speak from my perspective, share some observations based on experience across almost 3 decades of public policy. My aim is to share space with you and be in conversation with you today in our language, the way that we speak, yarning. If you're here today with a hunger for empirical data and fancy charts, I will no doubt disappoint you. as we navigate our Indigenous worlds using Indigenous methodologies. Deep listening through yarning, reflection and exchange are essential ingredients. And relationality and reciprocity are key principles to guide our interactions with others. And we anticipate others' interactions with us. It is just under 3 weeks since the Voice referendum was held. The heaviness right now is ubiquitous. There is much hurt and pain and a numbness felt by many. Indeed, this talk has challenged me in all sorts of ways, and I'm not afraid to say so. The weight is shared collectively as a nation, regardless of the way you voted. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will continue to work through the referendum outcome, what it means to us, to our families, to our communities. And this may be the case for many fellow citizens. I was a delegate at Uluru and I was a signatory to the Statement from the Heart. But to be clear, the Productivity Commission did not, as is appropriate, express a view on the Voice referendum. I do want to share some of my previous work prior to the time that I joined the Commission. So if you cast your minds back to the early 2000s, there were distressing images of Aboriginal people in Central Australia plastered over the mainstream media, reporting on the impacts of petrol sniffing on the young people themselves and their families and communities. At this time, I headed up the substance use area of the Office for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health within the Australian Government Department of Health and Ageing. One of my jobs was to lead the development of the petrol sniffing strategy. So for 3.5 years, petrol sniffing became my daily concern, never far from my mind. Being a relatively low-level bureaucrat in Canberra carried enormous responsibility. And it was the local intelligence and solution finding that made all the difference, enabled by government policy, resourcing and later legislation. Prevalence data from Nunapa Health Council in the Anangu, Pitjantjatjara, Yankunytjatjara lands formed the basis of our analysis, not government data, which was non-existent. And information and support from others like Tungundjeri Council's Central Australian Youth Link-Up Service. The development of a low aromatic fuel, regional responses, youth support services, and of course, community leadership, eldership on this, led to significant declines in prevalence rates. And since its inception, the program has expanded coverage across a range of locations with sustained lower levels of petrol sniffing. A second example of success in shifting systems based on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander advocacy and know-how is when I worked as the CEO of the Indigenous Doctors Association. In 2005, when I commenced as CEO, there were about 90 Indigenous medical graduates in the history of this country and about 70 students in the pipeline. Our first Aboriginal doctor, Professor Helen Milroy, graduated medicine from the University of Western Australia in 1983, some 80 years after the first Māori doctor, Te Rangi Hiroa, Sir Peter Buck, and over 100 years post-graduation of first doctors in North America. AIDA, as the peak body for doctors and medical students, drove reform of medical schools accreditation in collaboration with medical deans, Indigenous medical support, education support units and curriculum designers and developers. This was a monumental shift for those responsible for educating and training Australia's medical workforce. The training and educating of the medical workforce was not the job of AIDA as the peak body. It was the job of medical deans and training specialist colleges. According to AIDA in 2020, there were an estimated 600 Indigenous medical graduates. This represents an exponential rise over the past two decades. These two stories are from my lived experience, as more than an observer, as a participant in the change design and implementation process. And both stories, I hope, reflect to you the value of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, perspectives, priorities and knowledges in driving that change. Neither was easy, it never is. And while Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have the knowledge, the science and the solutions, too often their solutions fall on deaf ears or are not seriously considered due to the inflexibility of systems and structures. These are typically referred to in policy speak as barriers, and there have been innumerable workshops and reports written on reporting on identifying and reporting on barriers, then little done to overcome them. Indigenous knowledges to activate change are not properly valued, meaning poor results are reproduced and the fulcrum of power remains immovable. These stories are examples of promise from 15 to 20 years ago, with results carried through to this day. And most importantly, the positive impacts have and will accrue for generations to come. Today, the National Agreement on Closing the Gap demands a transformation of systems. All governments have committed to this outcome. This is not possible, though, without changes in mindsets and culture. Like many of you, prior to joining, I knew of the work of the Productivity Commission, but really only at a superficial level, and largely in relation to the Indigenous products, if you like, the Overcoming Indigenous Disadvantage Report and the Indigenous Expenditure Report. The engagement at that time from the Commission was initiated by good people who worked within the Commission who had courage for producing these reports. But other than that, my perception of the Commission's work was that there was very little attention paid to the perspectives, the priorities, the knowledges of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I will draw on some of the work during my time at the Commission, but at first let me cover off on some information about the Commission. So the Commission is the Australian Government's independent research and advisory body. The Commission operates under the protections of its own legislation, the Productivity Commission Act, and our activities cover all levels of government and encompass all sectors of the economy, as well as social and environmental issues, and a growing body of work around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander research and policy. In 2018, the Act was amended to create a position to strengthen research and evaluation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander policies. The Act requires that at least one commissioner must have extensive skills and experience in dealing with policies and programs that have an impact on Indigenous persons, and have experience in dealing with one or more communities of Indigenous persons. It took an amendment to the Act to guarantee an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander seat at the table. In 2019, I commenced my five-year term. The Commission has two roles in relation to the National Agreement on Closing the Gap, one around updating and publishing a dashboard comprising data and associated supporting materials on progress toward the targets, the second on conducting an independent review of progress every 3 years. Jackie, I've taken my watch off, but you'll give me the push along if I'm a bit... Thank you. Importantly, the whole of Commission's work program must take account of the potential implications and impacts for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And in some areas, the need is clear. For example, there are current inquiries around early childhood education and care and philanthropy, for example. Others less so, like our trade and assistance reviews. Our other standing functions, the reporting on government service provision, reviews of national agreements such as housing and homelessness, schools reform, the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, draft report released earlier this week, all need to take account of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And indeed, our reviews of all intergovernmental agreements, whether explicitly referred to in the terms of reference given to us by government or not, must address Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as a part of the inquiry process. I'm really proud to say that the Commission is working on developing an Indigenous outcomes framework, which I jointly chair with my colleague Lisa Studdett, the head of office, who's here today. This framework is to guide the Commission's work going forward. And it's work underway, but it will include our research, our analysis, our engagement, our cultural capability. And the aim is to have the framework completed in early 2024. In contemplating centering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in policy, I will draw upon two areas of work that I've been involved in during my time at the Commission: the Indigenous Evaluation Strategy and the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. My aim is to share the Commission's thinking on these two projects, noting that the review on the National Agreement on Closing the Gap is not yet complete, so I'll speak largely to the material from our draft report released in late July. Beyond the focus on these two areas today, I invite you to look at other Commission work as it relates to outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And a key piece of work that we did last year was the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Visual Arts and Crafts Study. Many of you might have heard about the proliferation of fake art, for example. So that study's got a bunch of things in there. To the Indigenous Evaluation Strategy, the day that I arrived at the Commission was the day that we received the Commission from Government to undertake development of the strategy. And we looked at the state of evaluation practice and identified a number of problems, including poor quality evaluations, the ad hoc way evaluations were undertaken, limited engagement with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and the limited usefulness of evaluation. Worryingly, though policymakers agree that evidence is critical for good policy making, many admit that in practice they do not rely heavily on evidence or past experience when formulating or modifying policies and programs. These mindsets and practices compound the trust gap between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and governments, and this is especially amplified when evaluation reports are not made publicly available. Trust between government and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is particularly important in light of Australia's colonial history and the ongoing impacts of that history. We saw four reasons for an Indigenous evaluation strategy stemming from these problems that I mentioned earlier, and the need to include this centering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people perspectives, priorities and knowledges in evaluations. The need to lift the bar on the quality of evaluations. So thinking early about what evaluations, how evaluations capture the true impacts of policies and programs on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and using data and approaches that are both technically sound and culturally appropriate. The need to enhance the use of evaluations, so communicating results, ensuring governments use evidence to inform the policy work to improve the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And we thought that there was a strong need for a whole of government approach to priority setting and evaluation. In fact, establishing evaluation leadership and oversight to ensure government agencies undertake evaluations in line with the key principles that we put forward. What Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people value, their knowledges and lived experience experiences needs to be reflected in what is evaluated, how evaluation is undertaken, and the objectives of policies and programs. And I go back to this centering notion, needing to recognise the diverse cultures, the language, the knowledge systems, the beliefs, the histories of our many peoples, our nations across this continent, the impacts of the contemporary and historical policies and programs on the well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We think that the centering principle supports Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights to self-determination and aligns with the national agreement. This necessarily requires governments changing the way that they work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. In practice, the principle means evaluations are undertaken in areas and address the issues that are most important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Again, that governments routinely consider the impact of their mainstream policies on and programs on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that Indigenous people have the opportunity to decide how they want to be involved in evaluations. Often the refrain about our people being the most researched people in the world rings true. So Indigenous people need to make decisions about where their priorities are in terms of engaging in evaluation processes. And the need for evaluation processes to strengthen and support evaluation capability of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We've heard that some agencies are being guided by the strategy, but much more could be done, including embedding the strategy across the Australian Public Service in partnership with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The establishment of the new Australian Centre for Evaluation within Treasury provides a unique opportunity to facilitate this whole of government work. Work such as the Mae Kawaiu and the Yarru Wellbeing Studies, the Murrunooka Justice Reinvestment Project, or the Literacy for Life Foundation are all putting together community-identified metrics to address the inadequacies of mainstream data. And in the process, people are empowered to change the narrative on their terms. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander governance and research tools are key to bridging the knowledge gap that exists in governments. Government's understanding of what is important for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The Indigenous Evaluation Strategy highlighted examples of Indigenous evaluative tools, methodologies, if you like, such as yarning, dadiri, which is deep listening, which were used to make sense of Western logics, Western planning concepts, such as program logic, and to develop policies which better reflect the experiences and priorities of the people most impacted. This is in stark contrast to evaluation practice the Commission uncovered within government. We surveyed government agencies, this Australian government agencies, asking them about the evaluations they had undertaken in the 2 years prior to the study. The results showed that only about 30%, it's about one in three, of evaluations of Indigenous-specific policies and programs involved engaging with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the evaluation decision-making. It's a pretty stark finding. And even worse, just one in 56 evaluations of mainstream policies and programs engaged with Indigenous people in the decision-making. These are two areas that are worth much more attention. The Australian government, the ACT government's commitments to measuring what matters at the population level highlights the importance of this work. And I think there's work to be done around thinking about the connection between productivity and wellbeing. So each of the initiatives and projects I mentioned above, and there are so many more, will enhance government's understanding around these matters. It is essential that any work going forward take account of what matters most for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Excuse my croakiness. So to the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. Since its first iteration in 2008, approaches to closing the gap had failed to achieve their goals. And due to this lack of progress, a different approach was employed and adopted in 2020, with government signing on for a major change in how they work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And three things are worth highlighting about the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations are parties to the agreement through the strong leadership and advocacy of the coalition, what became the Coalition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peak Organisations. So for the first time, all jurisdictions, local government, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander Peak Organisations negotiated an agreement, an intergovernmental agreement. The agreement elevates the cultures and expertise of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and community-controlled organisations, and it commits governments to an unprecedented structural shift in the way that they work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through four new priority reforms. Parties to the agreement committed to mobilising all avenues available to them to achieve the objective of the agreement, the objective being to overcome the entrenched inequality faced by too many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people so that their life outcomes are equal to those of all Australians. The agreement states that when Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have a genuine say in the design and delivery of services that affect them, better life outcomes are achieved. And consistent with this, the Productivity Commission has aimed to centre Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's perspectives, priorities and knowledges in our work, as well as, and importantly, in the work that we're doing under the review. The inclusion of the four priority reforms sets this agreement apart from previous initiatives falling under that Closing the Gap umbrella. And I'll just share with you those four priority reforms. Not everyone's familiar with them. So priority reform one is about formal partnerships and shared decision making, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are empowered to share decision making authority with governments to accelerate policy and place-based progress on closing the gap through formal partnerships. The second is about building the community control sector, that there is a strong and sustainable Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community control sector delivering high-quality services to meet the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across the country. The third is transforming government organisations. Governments, their organisations and their institutions are accountable for closing the gap and are culturally safe and responsive to the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, including through the services that they fund. This transformation agenda isn't just about government departments alone. It states clearly here, including the services that they fund as well. And priority reform four is about shared access to data and information at the regional level, meaning Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have access to the capability to use locally relevant data and information to set and monitor the implementation of efforts to close the gap for their priorities and to drive their own development. So this is about local level priority setting to drive communities' own development and the responsibility of governments to share information and data. The agreement itself says that these four priority reforms will accelerate improvements in the targets, the socioeconomic outcomes. That's the program logic. And while it's not explicitly stated, the agreement aims to improve the life outcomes through changes to the relationship, the how, between governments and Indigenous people to enable self-determination. In short, the priority reforms are expected to improve the socioeconomic outcomes through centering of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives and knowledges in policies and programs. In turn, this will promote greater recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures, and this recognition will reinforce efforts to strengthen Indigenous leadership in the design and delivery of policies and programs through that shared decision-making authority. This will ultimately lead to more culturally safe and responsive policies and programs, and by definition, services. Indigenous people will be able to access better quality services that meet their priorities and the priorities of their communities. And this will reduce the barriers to participation in the social and economic activities and lead to improved socioeconomic outcomes. So this is our understanding, the Productivity Commission's understanding of that logic that sits within the national agreement. So we've been working on this review for over 15 months. It's been an extensive piece of work right across the country. To draft report, we had just under 200 meetings, 130-odd of those with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations and communities. So it's an extensive piece of work, and our draft report that we put out in July provides our assessment so far. Given that we've still got work to do, most of my reference here today is drawing on that draft report, as I mentioned earlier. And the Commission has come to the view that governments are not adequately delivering on their commitments that they've made under the agreement. This is our overall assessment. We recognise that, of course, there is variation within organisations, within jurisdictions, and across jurisdictions. And our report points to a number of areas that some progress has been made. But it seems like in many cases where there is good practice, it's not necessarily being driven by structural change. It often seems very personality dependent and driven by the leadership, indeed, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and organisations themselves. Such as where shared decision making occurred only where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander parties had pushed governments to come to the table. And in some cases, declining the offer of government funding grants that did not reflect the priority of their communities, thereby changing that dynamic between governments and governments as funders, changing the dynamic from a top-down approach or government-led approaches. Parts of government agencies have also told us how they have to struggle within their own bureaucracies to trial new ways of commissioning, for example, that allows flexibility in contract design and to bring communities into the decision-making process on how services are designed and delivered. These problems do not appear to stem from the rules of the game, but speak to cultures within governments that have not transformed to share power, which intrinsically sits, foundationally sits in that priority reform one that I mentioned earlier. The task facing governments and government organisations is to make structural and cultural changes that embed partnership and shared decision-making authority, build the community control sector, transform their own organisations and how government undertake data activities. This means an honest look at the sharing of power. And some governments have demonstrated a willingness to partner and share decision-making in some circumstances. But as I said earlier, this is not observed more widely. And in some instances, there is contradictory practice that contradicts the principles and the intent of the agreement. Some governments are taking steps to change the business as usual approach to relationships engagement, with some now more willing to partner, trial new approaches and engage in shared decision making. But this appears to be especially true where legislation or agreements mandate this approach, such as the legislation and frameworks underpinning treaty processes in Victoria, for example, or when there are compelling drivers in the form of crises, for example, the COVID-19 pandemic. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have plainly said to us, if government saw so much value in us during the pandemic to come together as equals, why cannot that be so in all of their work? These are key questions to be put. Governments are not yet sufficiently investing in the partnerships or enacting the sharing of power that needs to occur. And more generally, there appears to be an assumption that governments know best, which is contrary to the principle, as I've said, of shared decision making. Too many government agencies continue to have their versions of shared decision making, and this involves consulting with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people on their predetermined solutions rather than collaborating on the problem and co-designing a solution. So governments have not or don't seem to have grasped the nature and the magnitude of the transformation that is required and their ways of working and sharing power. Among the hundreds of actions that governments are pursuing, there is no clear strategy for transformation that underpins those individual actions. Governments need to put forward what are called implementation plans, and counting the number of actions under those jurisdiction implementation plans amount to about 2,000 actions. The point here is that there has been no clear strategy of how those actions align with the achievement of closing the gap. And it is not at all clear that governments have deeply examined their systems, their structures, and their operations in the way that the agreement requires. That is a problem if you are trying to drive structural change. Some government organisations are engaging in self-assessment exercises to understand what transformation is needed. But we would say that transformation can only be realised by drawing on the experiences, the perspectives, the priorities of those who governments serve, in this case, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and working together with this knowledge to develop those strategies. Without external perspectives, government agencies will not be able to overcome their blind spots. And these blind spots are particularly in relation to systemic or institutional racism, concerns around cultural safety, or unconscious bias. And as I said earlier, governments are continuing to make decisions that contradict their commitments in the agreement and, in fact, exacerbate rather than remedy disadvantage and discrimination. And we've seen some instances of that recently in a range of jurisdictions where knowingly changes that have taken place have increased, for example, the number of young people who are incarcerated, knowingly increased. There are no consequences for failures as well, as we see it. In our draft report, we recommended or asked for further information on a suite of potential reform directions. In broad terms, these involve mechanisms that embed responsibility and accountability for public sector staff to act in accordance with the agreement. These could be key performance indicators in employment requirements, for example, performance assessments. Ensure that central agencies lead system-wide changes in the way that programs and services are designed, including through changes to cabinet, budget, funding and contracting processes, and broadening and clarifying the role of what is contained within the agreement, the commitment to independent mechanisms to monitor the transformation of government. And we're putting forward the need for those independent mechanisms to go beyond that priority reform 3, which is about transformation of government actually needs to apply to the whole of the agreement. So, governments must relinquish their hold on power for there to be progress on closing the gap. Notwithstanding work underway within governments, achieving better outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will be unachievable without this happening. This means centering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in the policy making and the evaluation efforts. In other words, this means privileging and prioritising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voices. This will only happen if governments transform their systems, their mindset and their culture. Structural reform is needed in the public sector, stewarded from the top with individual agency responsibility. And accountability is required throughout the system, from departmental heads through to policy officers and frontline workers. Institutional racism, to some unconscious bias, remains a major issue and must need to be addressed. Agencies will need external Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander assessments to help deal with these blind spots. It is both undesirable and ineffective for agencies to try to do this on their own. As we move forward toward finalising our report, which will come out, which will be delivered to the Joint Council on Closing the Gap, meaning all jurisdictions, ministers and the Coalition of Peaks, we will deliver that by the end of the year. But I do want to say that we recognise the range of work that's underway already. Our overall assessment is that governments haven't delivered on their commitments under the agreement, but we recognise there is a range of work underway. Process is important, but process alone cannot be used as a justification for the slow pace or indeed inertia. Some think of this as a 10-year agreement for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Wrestling power from government has been pursued for generations. And for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, this is a question of our very existence. Governments must relinquish power and control for the best decision-making, the best policy-making to happen. We will then have a better chance of the gap being closed. Thank you.
From perhaps if we sit down for the question and answer, we've got about 10 minutes for that. I think that's been very thought-provoking, and it's generous of you to share that perspective that comes from 30 years of labouring on both the side of delivery and now in your role at the Productivity Commission. I think I've appreciated you being very upfront too about what remains to be done, but also giving us the hope of some examples of what success looks like and how there could be a different approach. If you have a question, there are a couple of helpers at the side, Rory and Philia, who've got mics. So if you put up your hand, we'll bring a mic to you. If you don't do that, then I will steal all of the opportunity to ask questions. So, any takers? Just at the back there, Philia. I always think I'm going to get mine in first, but there.
thanks very much, Commissioner Morcag, for your address. In the voice referendum and on other occasions, we've seen reports and evaluations of Indigenous people and organisations sort of misrepresented to contribute to misinformation and sort of contribute to a deficit discourse about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. What can the Commission do, and what can we as practitioners of evaluation and analysis do to stop findings being misused or to minimise that?
Thank you. Thanks for the question. At the Commission level, we've been very intentional about not perpetuating deficit discourses, negative narratives about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we're very much focused on kind of throwing that way of viewing the world out and looking at strengths. And some might speak to strengths-based languages in reporting. In all of your analytical work, you know what ends up on the page. But it does require, and I wanted to point to those examples where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people sort of basically said, we can't rely on, you know, administrative data sets, non-Indigenous researchers alone to do this for us. So the Mayo Kawaiyu study, a longitudinal study, very clear about that. The Yarru, I'm Jugan, member of the Yarru people. The work that is happening in the Kimberley, the West Kimberley, is about us saying these are the things that are important for us. So one thing might be, you might have a metric around that reciprocity thing, for example. I don't see a whole lot of that being reported on in national collections, national surveys. For the Yarra study, trying to conceptualise of the importance of reciprocity, our obligations to each other and our kin as Indigenous, as First Peoples, was encapsulated through a measure which is simply when you go out fishing, what did that look like? Did you get a catch? And if you did get a catch, did you share that catch with others? And it's a really simple concept, right? But deeply embedded in place and culture and ancestry. But you're not going to get that sort of stuff thought about necessarily through a mainstream mindset. The Lowitja Institute, when I was the CEO of a minuscule budget, really, when compared to the National Health and Medical Research Council, we had a $5 million a year budget, of which about $3 million went to research and a bit more to translation. As CEO, we put $1 million into the Mayo Kawaiyu study because it was so important that we, Indigenous people, do that work ourselves. To the question of how things are reported, we saw that writ large in the lead up to the referendum. The $33.4 billion figure gets trotted out relating to the Indigenous Expenditure Report, a product delivered by the Commission, where data is accrued from, you know, jurisdictions. That was reported as $33.4 billion going into, or seemingly going into, the hands of Aboriginal people and Aboriginal organisation, with this question of where's the money going and what are the outcomes. A completely false premise, but allowed to run. The Commission felt concerned enough to put out a statement during that process to say this is what the Indigenous Expenditure Report is, what it says, what it can't say, what it doesn't, the restrictions, the parameters around what it does say. And it cannot track individual program dollars and outcomes. The fact of the matter is less than 20% of that $33.4 billion goes to direct services for Aboriginal, specific services for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Most of the other is at the population level and apportioning an amount, an estimate at a population level. So complete misreporting on that one. Sorry, I know it was a long response, but...
It's a complex question. Yeah. a further question from the audience just down here.
Thank you very much. You spoke in your talk about research looking at the number of times that policies that had a direct impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people involve consultation with affected communities. Did the research show anything about the quality of that consultation and the point at which the consultation was undertaken, whether it was sort of before the policy was developed or it was sort of more of a, this is happening and then we're now telling you?
Yeah, so the figures that I gave, the sort of 30% of Indigenous-specific programs, policies and programs, had a connection to asking Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people whether they, participated in the evaluations. This is a design of the evaluation all the way through. And then the mainstream one, 1 out of 56 or whatever that was. None of that really goes to the quality of the work or where in that evaluation process the engagement might have happened. But more often than not, what we heard was that the idea of consultation, and I alluded to some of this in my talk, is an afterthought. Decisions have been made, they're predetermined, and then it's a bit like a tick box. That was consistent with evaluation. And often evaluations would arise for not for the imperative to understand and learn and adapt, but often right at the end of a lapsing program, coming towards the end of that program, and the need to either continue or discontinue seemed to be an impetus for evaluation. Oftentimes it just too late to do the work properly with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal communities.
Right, I think we have time for one more. I think Rory will feel left out if there's no one on this side. If there isn't one from the audience, I have got... you talked about the resistance in bureaucracies to changing culture, and I just wondered whether you have any thoughts about where you've seen things that do help to nudge those changes, what works to bring organisations out of the fear of involving people from the beginning in design.
In the talk, there were examples, the stark example of COVID. So these go to existential questions for the whole of the population, not just Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and the legislative and other frameworks, for example, committed to in Victoria to achieve self-determination through truth-telling and treaty. So I think there's something to be said about that. I really don't like the language of authorising environment, but there's something to be said about that. And that sits squarely in terms of the bureaucracy at the level of the leaders of the public sector, right? So we've got a secretary's board that is written into public service legislation. The head of the National Indigenous Australians Agency sits at that board. The board is contemplating and moving on a range of things. All of that, recognising the independence of agencies as well, but all of that's important, that leadership. And I'm just thinking of my time as a kind of pretty low-level bureaucrat, really. I left the public service as a... Canberra people will understand what an EL2 is. but working with two secretaries in health that themselves saw that there was more than value in what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had to say. And one of them that I worked under... And I chaired an Indigenous staff network during my time at Health for a while, 150-odd staff across the country. And that leadership from the top was critical. And there was a sense that nothing is insurmountable, right? And if I was in a conversation as the chair of the network with the chair of corporate, that was kind of what was done. So when we meet with the secretary, and I had 6 monthly meetings with the secretary, and I'm sure it happens across the public service now, it wasn't about what can't be done, but what should be done, what will we do? And this is 20 years ago, right? We didn't have a national agreement on closing the gap and a priority reform on transformation to do that. So leadership is critical. And like I said in the talk, it's not just about the kind of technical instruments that are employed, but this is about mindset, about culture. And I've just got a lot of confidence in the goodness of people, and but that's insufficient. We need the structural reform to go with it. So it's not an easy answer, no. But it's a part of it.
Well, thank you very much. I think it really has left us with a lot to think about, and you've tried to tackle some very big issues, and we've only given you an hour, so thank you. I've got some instructions to announce the next lecture in case you are keen to turn up, which is on Friday, the 1st of December. It's our Harry Evans Memorial Lecture, and it will be the former Chief Justice of the High Court, the Honourable Justice... I suppose he has to lose his Justice Robert French. That concludes our formal proceedings, but could you join me in thanking Rom again for his talk?